Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha, good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. You may hear us every Sunday at 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Thank you so much to our sponsor, Hawaiian Ukulele and Guitar at King Shops and on Ali'i Drive. And the podcasts are online, lava1053.com and koacountry1077.com. Just click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. Back in 2012, we talked with Jeff Melrose, who had authored a baseline study about food self-sufficiency on Hawaii Island in partnership with UH Hilo. I found it one of the most excellent studies ever, filled with great information, and I was not the only one. It was very widely praised. Now, Jeff has worked in partnership with UH Hilo to create the statewide agricultural land use baseline 2015, and that's what we'll talk about today. Good morning, Jeff. Aloha.
Good morning, Sherry. Always nice to be with you.
It's good to have you back. So, first of all, what did the state ask you to do? What is this agricultural study that you have now produced with UH Hilo?
Well, essentially, we contracted through the University of Hawaii at Hilo what's called the Spatial Data Analysis and Visualization Lab, which is the GIS, Geographic Information System, facility at the University of Hawaii. What Department of Ag asked us to do was to create a digital map of the footprint of agriculture on a statewide basis. In other words, it gave us a way to depict the whole of the agricultural activity, particularly the larger scale activities. A lot of the small ones are a little hard to get our hands around, but certainly the to give us a current map. And part of the reason for that was that, you know, I think as I went around the state doing this work, what I realized is that there are many people who know well the agriculture they're engaged in their own communities. And I use the analogy of the old story of the blind man holding on to different pieces of the elephant, each one holding an ear or a tusk or a foot and describing the elephant. And I think this is an effort to try and get a little bit higher elevation look at the whole of it and to see what it tells you, both looking backwards and where we are emerging and as a way to measure growth forward.
Why did the state want to do this?
Our data on agriculture is poor. We have not been collecting production data of a variety of kinds of things. But this is a way to improve the level of conversation about agriculture so that we are keeping in mind the bigger picture rather than just following the hot item on the table today, which is what happens often. So this is an effort to cast a common view of the agricultural footprint and will help us identify what kinds of agriculture are going where, what waters serve those agricultures, and perhaps from that will come some ability to set some priorities about where you go next. So it's part of a tool for that conversation. It doesn't carry your recommendations, but it says this is the basis for some good thinking about it. So it hopefully informs the discussion going forward.
Well, I found this study, as I looked at it, to be very much focused on land use, not just food sustainability. And I was kind of intrigued that some of the information the state has collected goes back as far as 1937 or before, but the state really has not done a look at this since 1980, and that's 35 years, kind of like two generations.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that the last time we did the digital footprint of agriculture in the state was in 1980. It was called the Agricultural Land Use Map. And it's been sitting in a GIS file at the Office of Planning. You can pull it up and look at it. But that did give us a chance to really look at the whole scope of change. In 1980, we had 14 plantations and sugar plantations and four pineapple operations on about 300,000 acres. Today, we have total sugar and pine at just over 40,000 acres. And the largest, 38,000 acres of that at HCNS, are on the way out.
And that's on Maui.
It's on Maui. So what we're really measuring is the post-plantation era reemergence of agriculture on a statewide basis. And one of the first things you see right off the bat is we're actually about 200,000 acres less in crop production today than we were in 1980. There are 150,000 acres in crop today. There were about 350,000 acres in crop then. Same with pasture. There was 1.1 million acres of pasture in 1980. Today, we mapped about 750,000 acres. Some of it just being bought and sold by government agencies, national parks, the Army, a number of them. But there is a substantial reduction in the total amount of land available or in production today.
What do you think the implications of that are? It sounds bad to me, but is it bad?
Well, I mean, I think you have to start from the perspective that sugar was a grass and grew at pretty much any slope at lots of elevations. It was a very flexible crop. So we've reached our high tide mark. We're not going to get back up to that high tide mark in terms of total crop acres. The next era is really more about smaller, more intensive agriculture than what sugar was. And that's just the truth of post-plantation life. The bigger question is, where has it survived and where has it migrated to? What agriculture has migrated where? And I think that's what you see when you look at this mapping effort, is to see what is emerging and areas that aren't emerging. And I think it tells us about, if you're really trying to make efforts to improve agriculture, you need to blow on the embers of what's working and spend less time in the areas where it's not, if you're really trying to get traction. So that's part of the kind of an underlying thought about how you would use such a thing.
How do you actually do such a study? How did you do this study? It sounds pretty complex to me.
Well, a lot of it is satellite aerial interpretation using geographic information. And so we used a variety of different aerial imagery, WorldView 2, Google Earth, numbers of them, to identify where crops were and digitize their actual footprint. And then I spent a fair amount of time out going around the state checking, looking for myself, driving, talking to people, trying to understand what was, has been, would be coming. So it's that combination. Then we also got some real property tax data, so you can kind of see where people say they're farming in the real property tax records, and some agricultural water use records. And we use those largely just to verify or to help draw our eyes towards agriculture or places for agriculture. Then we digitized that, and then the maps were all put into Illustrator and produced what I think was an excellent group of graphics. And just a quick shout-out for the two people that worked with me in this process. Dr. Ryan Peroy at the University of Hawaii's Geography Department is the manager of the SDAV lab and a great editor and a good thinker in GIS. And we really are fortunate to hire an excellent cartographer and GIS analyst, Silviana Carrez, who put together the maps and brought us the quality graphics that we have in the report today.
Jeff, you mentioned water, and it seems that water is a huge factor in how land can actually be used. And of course, if you just look at Hawaii Island, last September we had more rain than we've ever had in recorded history because of El Nino, and now because of El Nino, we're in a huge drought. So talk about the issues surrounding water, not just for Hawaii Island, but for the state, because that has to control a lot of how land gets used.
Yeah, that it is true. And keep in mind that a lot of the agriculture we have on this island is inherently unirrigated. So most of what's on the windward side of the island, you know, runs off of catchment or off of Mother Nature. That was the way sugar was done on the Hamakua Coast. There was only about 4,000 or 5,000 acres irrigated on the entire Hamakua Coast from the Hamakua Ditch. The rest of the 50,000 acres of cane were unirrigated and relied on rainfall. Puna, the same thing. It was an unirrigated plantation. So in some cases and in some environments, water is real critical. In others, water is available. And the shortness in that is often the soils are less fertile because the water is, you know, falls on it regularly. So one of the things that we did in the report was to map what water systems served what farm areas. And I think there's a really interesting observation in that, is because we kind of tend to think that surface water is the water that is our agricultural water, that it's cheap, it flows downhill, we collect it mauka, we take it out of streams. But in truth, a lot of the agriculture around the state is provided for by the domestic water system. Most of Kona is supplemental agriculture other than rainfall. People are using the county water systems. All of Waianae, you know, which is about 550 acres of diversified crop, is entirely domestic water. Much of Kula, all of Kula actually, is domestic outside of the county ag park. And then in Oahu, there are well systems at the higher elevations, which makes water more expensive. Particularly the higher you lift it, the more it's going to cost. So understanding the difference between surface flow waters, domestic waters, privately pumped sources, has a lot to do with what's going to, what waters are available to do what. And we've also gone through an era where both from the water code, the adoption of the water code, and then some of the dam safety requirements that have come along since the Colocho Reservoir collapse.
And you mean DAM safety, not DAMN safety?
Yes, I think that's true.
I just wanted to make sure you weren't criticizing the safety regulations.
No, not the dam safety. Yes. Excuse me. But I think that those have actually resulted in the removal of some key infrastructures in different places around the state, that landowner liability for an old plantation reservoir that used to serve large areas is now a liability to a landowner. And if they don't either decommission it or downsize it, they'll hold a long-term liability for it. So you're seeing some of the important infrastructure get undone at the same time when we know storage at a higher elevation is an issue for some regions, not every region, but certainly in some.
You know, you're looking at ag lands, but the demand for water is also very much impacted by development. And I know there's that pull of developers wanting more water for what they're doing.
Again, it's a regional issue. It exists in areas, you know, on the Sunshine Coast, where water is less likely and development is more prominent. On the Hamakua Coast and the Hilo Coast, water's not an issue. But yes, there is. And then there are these blended systems like the HCNS system on Maui, the East Maui Irrigation, which brings in millions and millions of gallons of water daily out of the eastern streams along the Hana Coast. But a fair amount of that ends up in domestic water. And just as it does in West Maui, there's the Mahina Hino intake takes 2 million gallons out of a ditch system and disperses it to that portion of Lahaina. So there is a blending of those two systems, and in some senses it keeps them running. As long as there's a domestic demand, that's going to keep people paying attention, maybe more than it for agricultural purposes.
I want to ask you about island by island, but in general, can you make some conclusions about land use statewide?
Yeah, I think there are, aside from the general demise of the total acres in production, which happened under Sugar, one of the most pronounced things, I think, that struck me when we finally got a chance to sum up some of these numbers was that there's more diversified agriculture, meaning food-based, leaf crops, root crop agriculture, on the island of Oahu than there is in the rest of the state combined. So that all of the rest of the islands don't have as much diversified ag as the central plain of Oahu, pretty much. And I think that that's really a product of the role of the marketplace and the proximity of that marketplace to a small farmer or to a large farmer who can bring those lands into productivity and take their product on a regular basis to a large market on the back of their truck, as opposed to us having to ship it from Young Brothers or, you know, finding other handling mechanisms that we have to get it into the marketplace. So market, the gravity of market that draws products into it, have filled in the central plain of Oahu, and that's going to continue. The state's still looking at acquiring more land for more farming in that area. And it does have a competition impact. I've heard both farmers in Lalamilo and in Kula complain that, you know, they're having a hard time being as successful as they once were because somebody else is producing the cabbage and the lettuce closer to marketplace. So those are basic market realities that affect who does what where.
One thing I've heard you say, though, that surprised me is a lot of the crops grown in the state are exported.
Certainly. I mean, just think, you know, the sugar crop, certainly an export crop. Macadamia is an export crop. The seed business is an export crop. The papaya business, we would probably be growing papaya, but we wouldn't be growing near as much as we are today. But maybe 50% of that goes out of state. Where there are market opportunities, farmers are going to take them. The fact that cattle are being shipped off of this island to go to the mainland as young wean-offs is largely because of the price of that they can get on the mainland. Now, that price is going to drop and has dropped, but the fact is it gives market choice to the rancher themselves. So there is a lot of export, and I'd say on the neighbor islands, 70 to 80% of the acres that we produce on are for an export crop.
See, that interests me because we always talk about growing food that we can eat to provide a sustainable island so that we don't have to rely on exports. But if we're sending our food elsewhere, that sort of doesn't make any difference, does it?
Well, we're not, I mean, a lot of what we're sending away are boutique products. So they're not necessarily things that are going to make a difference. The Kona coffee business, we all drink coffee, but we don't all afford Kona coffee. So there's probably more sent off than we consume locally. Those are just, if there's an economics out there, it's going to draw it. And I also think that this conversation about local food production, truthfully, 10 years old, 15 years old, max, that this hasn't been the conversation we've been having until we start to feel somehow vulnerable to, you know, world prices and globalization. Those are now popular words, and they become, you know, they get interpreted into agriculture. But telling a farmer to grow a product that he can make a little margin on when they can grow another product and get a bigger margin. Waianae is a good example. It's an area that has been in local food production for many years, both dairy and pigs and chickens and green onions and a whole variety of other products that went right into the marketplace. Today, I'd say 300 of the 550,000 acres are in basil, and they're grown by Thai and Cambodian farmers who shipped it to Chicago and other northern climates by air. So, again, it's a decision you make because the market will help you as a farmer be more successful financially. So, I mean, money drives a lot of this conversation, and I don't know farmers, sustaining farmers who don't understand that truth about farming.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. We're here on the radio every Sunday morning, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, 8 a.m. Lava 105.3 FM. And you may hear the podcast online, lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Just click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. And thanks to the Island Issues sponsor, Hawaiian Ukulele and Guitar at King Shops and on Ali'i Drive. Today we're talking with Jeff Melrose in part one of a two-part conversation about the brand new statewide agriculture land use study. Next week we'll continue the conversation with Jeff, but I will also have a short talk story with the chair of the Hawaii State Department of Agriculture, Scott Enright, just to get his input on this study. Now let's get back to my conversation with Jeff Melrose. I sat in when you talked about this study with the Hawaii County Agricultural Commission, and one of the things that surprised me was the discussion about how who owns the land has a huge impact on the capability of people to use it for productive farming. Talk a little about that, land ownership and its impact.
So it's another one of those big issues that has been very apparent in the last 30 years. When you think about what Hawaii defined as the Big Five, AMFAC, Castle & Cook, Theo Davies, C. Brewer, A&B, those were the Big Five. They owned and controlled large, vast areas of the state. Today, three of those companies, AMFAC, C. Brewer, and Theo Davies, own 0 acres in the state. So all of those lands have gone to the winds of other users. The Campbell Estate, same thing. They sold off their land assets. There are a whole series of private corporations who are exiting their land holdings or harvesting their value, I guess is another way to say that. So that finding landowners who don't have an exit strategy has a lot to do with the kind, with where agriculture is going to work. And when I say they don't have an exit strategy, Kamehameha Schools, for instance, is a long-term landowner. They do not have an exit strategy. Their intention is to hold on to their land assets. And as a result, they can form a basis for some agricultural long-term leases that give farmers certainty. The state public lands don't have an exit strategy. They have lands for the purpose of long-term use. There are some new landowners who've come in and become that kind of a farmer. The Olson Trust has been good in Kau and in the Hamakua Coast. Families like the W.H. Shipman family who, you know, covet their holdings and wish to hold on to that. The Robinson Estate on Kauai, the same. They don't see themselves as leaving their assets behind. And as a result, they can make a different kind of an arrangement than somebody who's bought land at a inflated price and hopes to get an inflated plus return from it. So they keep their lease term short, and it's hard for a farmer to work in that circumstance.
Give us a brief look at land use on each of the islands. Let's start with Kauai.
You know, Kauai's agriculture is, there are a couple of large forces on Kauai. Certainly the seed industry has taken a substantial portion of the south shore of Kauai, and their operation primarily on some state lands and Robinson properties. Again, They both operate around large water systems that are maintained for their purpose. They're large enough to employ a whole lot of people. There's a basis of agricultural employment along the South Shore. Add to that the Kauai Coffee Company, 3,000 acres that A&B put in place, now managed by an Italian company. But as you go north from Lehui, those lands used to be Amfax properties, you see a much different kind of ag pattern, more small scale, more individual farmers trying to make a living, finding a niche marketplace. And you get up to the Kilauea lands, there's some very wealthy people that bought land up there, and this 0.1% of the wealth group, some have been very good at making their lands available for community activity or for agriculture. Others have really emphasized their own privacy and their own desires for agriscaping or landscaping their estates as opposed to production ag. And the other kind of oddity in that is the Hanalei taro fields, particularly those that have been purchased by the Fish and Wildlife Service, because those lands used to be all in taro, and now a substantial portion has been taken out to create bird habitat. And the farmers up there are struggling mightily against their inability to oosh birds from damaging their crops, and they're stuck. You know, the landowner's goal is bird population, not taro production. Oahu, the Central Plain, as we've talked about, is really a key piece of that. And the North Shore, particularly up around Kahuku, there's another 1,500-plus acres of diversified ag done by a variety of folks, the Turtle Bay Resort developer, the Hawaii Reserves, or the Mormon Church. And they see those and really hope to see those farmers be a part of their own businesses more actively. The Mormon Church would love to have farmers who are producing food for PCC and for the
Polynesian Cultural Center,
and BYU, Brigham Young, and for that community. So there are relationships in there that are good. We talked a little about Central Plain already and the urban interface that exists there, and there will be some removal of prime ag land from that location. But I think, you know, they have drawn some hard lines on Oahu in terms of where the urban can be and can't be, and we're just catching up with those lines now. Maui is interesting. Maui's got 44,000 acres of crops, 38,000 of it's in sugar.
So and that's going to go away, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, by the end of this year, early next year. So the challenge that Maui faces, it is the last, the largest, probably the most unified. Good news is A&B owns most of it, so it isn't like it's going to break up into a lot of little, you know, lessors' hands. They're going to hold most of that land. And they've been invested on that island for a long time. They're not likely to hit and run. But they are a stockholder-oriented company, and if somebody came up with an offer they couldn't refuse, they couldn't refuse it.
Well, so have they announced what they plan to do once they stop sugar production, whether they do plan to try to keep it in ag or do something else?
Well, I've been involved in some of those conversations and watched the evolution of this. It's too early to tell. The answer for Maui is patience. Every plantation that's gone through this change has taken 10 years to know what sticks and what doesn't stick. A lot of our first expectations never get met because the reality never appears. You know, it's talk and then the walk doesn't show. My bet is that a fair amount of it goes into pasture in the near term, simply because it's a way to get control of land management, to keep the weeds down, to get some grass growing, to get some control of property. People would like them to grow hemp. Hemp's still illegal. Until it is, they're not even planting test plantings. So there are lots of folks who think it'll all go into diversified ag, but there aren't that many farmers to do it. So that's a big challenge. I would predict that they're going to be real dusty for a time on Maui because of the wind and the central isthmus late fine dust. And if they can't get a water source into it, it's going to be worse. So those are big issues and things that Maui has to wrestle with. But it will take time and it will take patience.
Well, right now there is water for the sugar plantation. Would that water not therefore be available for any future ag?
The systems are there.
Okay.
The systems are there. The intakes, the reservoirs, the ditches. A portion of that water comes from a state water license that's been on a month-to-month lease for 14 years and involved in litigation primarily with taro growers and some folks advocating biology in the streams. And I think that's been a vested battle for a long time. My hope is that somewhere in this process, the leaders of all of those key players get to sit down and say, okay, let's put down the axes and the swords we've been wielding for 14 years and say, how are we going to make a better arrangement, because nobody's going to come into the Central Plain with anything at scale without a guarantee of water. You can't do it on a month-to-month agreement. So it's going to take some folks sitting down around a table and coming up to an agreement that works. And the longer you leave it in the courts and the lawyers, the more protracted and the harder it is going to be to find a solution.
What about the other two islands in Maui County, Molokai, Lanai?
Lanai has all of 50 acres, and it's a small patch of farming near the airport, and it's at a low ebb currently because the hotels have been down. So the couple growers who grow there, they can make deals with the guys who run restaurants, but when the restaurants are down, it's a problem. So we'll see what Larry Ellison has up his sleeve. He's working at some other bigger issues first, and ag will come around, but there's only about 50 acres there. And on Molokai, the seed industry is the largest user of ag land. There's also a fair amount of diversified agriculture. Larry Jeffs from the Sugarland Farms grows cucumbers and ships them to the Wahoo market. There are sweet potato growers and a number of others. And because there is no ring spot virus there, Kumu Farms is producing papayas that you see in the market as a non-GMO product. So they're niche marketing. There's not a lot of export out of that island. The island has a real expectation of being a self-sustained kind of a place, to its credit. But it's also not an easy thing, because when you grow one thing and somebody else grows it too, you have a very limited marketplace. A lot of that's on Hawaiian homelands and the state ag park right in Ho'olehua. On this island, we're about 60,000 acres of agriculture, cropland agriculture. Macadamia nuts and the forest industry, commercial forest industry, are the two largest pieces of that. And the third largest is, I think, is diversified ag. But we still are largely, you know, large. We have a lot of large-scale operations, and most of our diversified ag comes out of the Lalamilo farm lots and along the Hamakua coast, pretty much sweet potato, ginger, a couple of those kinds of crops.
When you talk about the forest industry on Hawaii Island, what is that? Talk about that.
Well, the bulk of it came as a result of a lease from Kamehameha Schools to originally Prudential Timber to put the eucalyptus trees up. The idea there was that they would be able to be selling them for a fiber chip.
Eucalyptus trees on the Hamakua coast, yeah?
Yes. There's about, I'd say, 17,000 acres of eucalyptus on that coast.
Skinny little eucalyptus.
Well, some are skinny. It depends on where you look. In certain parts of the plantation, they're much bigger. Others, they didn't get much bigger. But we do grow fast eucalyptus. And the issue there is really the current lessee has a lease for another 4 or 5 years. So they're trying to move as many of the trees as they can to harvest them and send them off at Kauai High, and they're going to China for primarily spun for plywood and or for making inexpensive pallets and the like. But because there is no user for the small ends of these trees, the tops and the small trees that you would otherwise chip and burn, those are being left in the field to some degree.
And an interjection, Jeff and I talked about the fact that Prudential was planning on using the chips as part of the biomass fuel at the Huhonua power plant. But on February 16th, the actual day that we recorded this interview, Helco announced they were intending to cancel the power purchase agreement with Huhonua because of Huhonua's financial troubles, which Jeff did reference with me. And now back to his conclusion on that topic.
That will make a big difference as to whether or not there is a forest industry here or not. There needs a way to use the kind of the guts and feathers of the forest industry to burn so that the bigger logs can find different kinds of uses. So there is an industry, and Kauai has already started to cut and burn some of their trees planned for that same purpose. There's a 9-megawatt power plant on the Kauai grid. A little trouble getting up and running right now, but it is headed that direction. Their wood basket is fairly small, though. They have a fairly small amount of trees actually planted.
What about koa trees? I know there's planting of koa trees going on, I believe, by Kamehameha Schools and some private organizations. What's that going to be used for?
It kind of depends on the planter themselves. In our project, I talked to most of those folks, and what I was looking for was who is really commercial and who is growing for the culture or the forest recovery goals. So Kamehameha Schools doing some great work all around the island in natural resource management protection. But their koa reforestation, particularly in the Keoho volcano area, is primarily, you know, let's rebuild a forest. Maybe we get a canoe log out of this, but we're not going to go in. They're not looking to harvest it, at least not at this point. There are others that are, I would say most of that is of the non-commercial variety, forest preservation, forest recovery. And then there are a few that are trying to grow it for long term. And there's a couple of folks on Kauai who are growing a whole series of exotic woods. Again, very wealthy people who bury their money in their own backyard and grow mahogany and pheasant wood and all these fancy woods for their children's children, perhaps, to harvest.
What about the papaya industry here on Hawaii Island? How's that doing?
Hawaii Island has about 90% of the state's papaya operation and has three for processing treatment options, different companies that have treatment facilities for export. They've had a hard couple of years. This has been a tough year, both from a storm perspective and from this kind of throttling they took around the GMO issue. And it takes a lot of wind out of the sails of farmers to think that they're no longer seeing in respectful ways, they're being treated in some offhand way for what they're doing. But I think that the industry has a variety of challenges in front of it, as all ag industries do. I think they are innovating at a variety of levels. That industry is about 50% of it is packing houses, and then the other 50% are independent growers who have their own marketing mechanisms. They don't necessarily treat, but they'll send them to Canada or someplace north where the bugs aren't an issue. The underpinnings of that business are stronger than they are in other places. There's some good corporate players struggling for that, trying to make money out of that business.
And with that, we're going to take a pause in our conversation with Jeff Melrose and continue it next week with part two of our discussion with Jeff about the study he and UH Hilo completed for the State Department of Agriculture. It's a statewide land use agriculture study. We'll also talk with Scott Enright. He's the chair of the Department of Agriculture and actually from this island and continues to live on this island. So we'll get his thoughts on this study. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. And thank you so much to our sponsor, Hawaiian Ukulele and Guitar at King Shops and on Ali'i Drive. And the podcasts are online, lava1053.com and koacountry1077.com. Until next Sunday, please, let's all live with aloha and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us, info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.